Welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Dr. Craig Barker. I'm the head of public engagement for the museum. Object Matters is a podcast series in which I interview a guest about an object or a set of objects in the museum collection, about their personal connection with those objects in one way or another. For this episode, I'm really, really excited to be joined by Dr. Heba Abdul El Gawat. Heba is an exhibition curator, a public outreach specialist, and a researcher in Egyptian heritage within museum contexts. She's the postdoctoral researcher for the project Egypt's Dispersed Heritage, Views from Egypt at the Institute of Archaeology at the University College of London, and she's published widely on the subject and on the relationship between modern and ancient Egypt in both English and Arabic. She was selected as one of the 21 most influential Egyptian women in 2021 for her community work in museums and in the heritage sector. Heba, welcome, or Alan.
Ahlan. Ahlan, Craig.
Thank you so much for joining us on Object Matters. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Opening up with a question, have you enjoyed your time in Australia so far?
Yes, I have. I've been telling everyone back home how vivid the colours here are, the level of visibility and transparency of... Because at home, perhaps you would feel that there is a layer of dust between you and everything else. Yes. Comes from the hot and dusty weather. But here is just... You and real green, real colour. So it's been a blast.
Well, it's really lucky you're not here while the bushfire seasons are on.
Alhamdulillah, not. No fires.
Now,
Only rain for now, yeah.
Now, could you begin by telling us a bit about your own career and your own interest? Where did you grow up in Egypt? Where did you study, and how and why did you become interested in ancient Egypt?
I was privileged, I think, and lucky enough to be brought up in Cairo. I was born in Cairo, and the privilege and the luckiness comes in where exactly I was brought up. I was brought up in the very middle of Cairo, in downtown, where the hustle and bustle happens, where you would see all the layers of Egypt's heritage, but equally Egyptian society. And I think that this has affected the way not only I see myself, but the way I see Egypt, and I see that the multiplicity of voices around Egypt, and how that there are as many Egyptian voices and opinions as there are many Egyptians. I've had my undergraduate degree at Helwan University, equally in Cairo, which was in Egyptology, but a broader strand of Egyptology where we get to study the full span of Egyptian heritage and archaeology up till contemporary time. And I was very lucky and privileged in that sense. And then I've moved to the UK for my postgraduate studies. And since then, I've been involved in a variety of museum and curatorial research, as well as exhibition displays, both in the UK and in Cairo. And I think what made me interested in the field of, I wouldn't say Egyptology, but what made me interested in looking into Egypt's past is that I've always growing up, the question that was always in my mind was like, what happened? How come we had this past and now we have this present, regardless of how this present is? But we were always taught about the glories of the past, and very rarely were we taught about the glories of the present. And I just wanted to understand how and why did we reach this very point? That was my motivation.
Well, I want to come back and explore that with you in a lot more detail. And I will obviously preempt this question by saying, you've just talked about the multiple voices, and you as an individual can't speak for 102 million Egyptians.
No, I can't.
But more generally, what is modern Egypt's relationship with ancient Egypt like? You talked about that really interesting opportunity you had to study all the way through, which we in the West don't have.
Yeah.
But does the average person on the street see a continuity all the way through, or is it far more complex than that?
It's far more complex, but it's also very organic and natural that we do it unknowingly. For example, the song that we sing every Ramadan, and Ramadan, it's the month that we get to observe in Islam with fasting and self-reflection, and it's a month of good deeds. And there is, the festivities within Ramadan in Egypt are very distinctive. They are different than the rest of the Muslim and Arabic-speaking world. And I think a lot of the traditions or a lot of the rituals that we do are very much from ancient Egypt. Even the song that we sing for Ramadan, that what we say, Ramadan is coming, that the moon has changed and Ramadan is coming, is Wahawiya, Wahawi. That's hieroglyphs. Huh? But people do it unknowingly.
Yes.
But that's the thing. It's not deliberate. We're not deliberately making links. We do it organically. It lives within us and in us, if that's something that I can say. Yeah. That's how I always see it. It's living in and within us as Egyptians. It comes with our lived experience that we don't deliberately, intentionally replicate ancient Egypt, but some things have continued
There's
to exist,
an awareness.
Others we've moved on. So, yeah.
I guess it's very difficult to ignore because of monumental architecture, for one.
Yeah.
But every time a foundations for a new building are being laid, then there are issues. So it's always there, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not really the monuments, but it's more the lived experience, I would assume. Us sharing the same land and living on the same environment, particularly the Nile. We have a very interesting relationship with the Nile that you would notice even from Egyptian songs, some modern songs, that it's very similar to the relationship that the ancient Egyptians had with the Nile. So it's this lived experience that we share, being brought up on the same land, coming from the same root, drinking from the very same Nile.
Yes.
That's what shaped us and made us who we are, be it in the past or in the present.
Is there a real pride in that history, more generally, do you think?
Yeah, there is. There is a lot of pride, but I think that because of the very focus on the glories of pharaonic Egypt, there is pride, but there is equally self-defeat.
Yeah.
That we always feel dwarfed compared to the ancient Egyptians, and this is something that I'm very keen to change.
Yeah. Well, I guess that segues very nicely
into
the project then. So Egypt's Dispersed Heritage, Views from Egypt. It's a project run out of the Institute of Archaeology at UCL. Can you talk a bit more about the project and its aims and your involvement with it?
Yes. So before this project, the main project was the Artifacts of Excavations that was led by Dr. Alice Stevenson at UCL. This was interested in documenting how and why did Egyptian heritage end up being dispersed all over the world through British-led excavations or British-led fieldwork. And the findings from the project were extremely, were mind-blowing. There is nearly tens of thousands of objects in 350 institutions. And by institutions, I don't only mean museums. There could be also weird places like someone's attic or a garage or something. So it doesn't have to be an official formal museum. In 27 countries in the 5 continents. So nearly there is a piece of Egypt at the doorstep of every city or town around the world.
That's extraordinary.
And this is extraordinary. And this is the largest of scale and scope archaeological endeavor of extracting objects from a culture and exporting it to the rest of the world during colonialism or through colonialism. So this was very interesting. What was equally interesting is how that the Egyptians are totally dismissed from the story. Nowhere do we hear of how the Egyptians felt about this, be it during the time when the extraction was happening or today. And there has been, since the 19th century, Egyptian voices standing against this extraction and this export of finds and making meaning of these objects and calling for a better representation of Egypt, even if they have to leave Egypt, a better or perhaps a more Egyptian way of displaying ancient Egyptian objects. But these voices remain unheard of and these views are unaccounted for. And we as a modern community from the 19th century up till today remain for some reason invisible.
Yes.
And that was the core aim of the project, is to use the findings that came from the Artifacts of Excavation, working with 5 partner museums in the UK, Manchester Museum, Liverpool World Museum, National Museums of Scotland, Horniman Museum and Gardens in London, and the Peachey Museum of Egyptian Archaeology, together with the Egypt Exploration Society, the driving force behind all such dispersal during the 19th century, and take all those findings and these collections and archives back to Egypt to nothing but to simply contribute to people's lives in the way they want, and to make sure that the Egyptians are actively involved in these discussions that the West remains dominating for years and years and centuries.
Yes. So bringing the voice back to Egypt.
Exactly. It's bringing the voice back to Egypt, or perhaps the voice in Egypt has always been there. It's just amplifying those voices in places which are dominated by non-Egyptian voices, giving space.
So I know some of the techniques you've used to do this have involved cartoons and comics, social media. Could you tell our listeners a bit about those aspects of the project?
Yeah, I always start with this, and I know I'm biased, and this is my I confess that I'm very biased, but we are known for our sense of humor. This is evidence-based. There is modern research that tends to prove that Egyptians have one of the best sense of humor in the world. But sense of humor, sarcasm, and satire, even from ancient Egyptian times, we still have evidence for that. This was our coping mechanism and the way that we criticize ourselves, but equally self-mockery, but equally the political and social system. That is our own form of activism. Yeah. And I felt that we wanted to contribute to Egyptians' life and to Egyptianize the narrative around Egyptian heritage. So the best thing would be using absolutely Egyptian, totally Egyptian modes in doing this. And one of it was comics, satire. And we've collaborated with few extremely talented and Egyptian comic artists who share our same values. They are all interested in highlighting the voice of Egyptian minorities, in making sure that those who are usually economically, socially are underrepresented, the volume is turned up on them. They are there and they are highlighted and they are not victimized. And we felt that the selection of artists we've got female artists, Dina Muhammad, Al Uzba Collective, and most importantly, Nasser Jr. or Muhammad Nasser. And they both spoke so much to our values and what we were keen on achieving that we felt they are the best partners. They are the ones that we want to be dominating these discussions and to help us initiate a dialogue with the Egyptians on these discussions. And obviously social media is a big thing in Egypt. Like people use it very differently than how it's used in the West. We use it to solve any problems, even sometimes for getting medical prescriptions, which is wrong, but people shouldn't do that. But yeah, you would find people like contacting doctors, sending them photographs of like a skin rash or something, asking for a prescription on Facebook, something you wouldn't do here. But it's just the multiplicity or the different ways of doing things that exist in Egypt. And we felt that this could be a platform for us to enter a dialogue with the Egyptians, offering them an opportunity to respond back to us. We wanted it to be a two-way dialogue. It's not just us dumping information into them and this is how things are, you should think this way. No, we were interested from the very beginning on amplifying the multivocality and on initiating a dialogue with the majority of Egyptians. And that seemed like the right platform to do this.
And how's the response been to date? I mean, what are you getting, questions and comments?
Amazing, amazing. Just before coming today, I got a Facebook message on the project Facebook page. Someone who lives in Virginia in the United States, and they were interested in knowing more about how objects from Egypt ended up in the States and what he can do about it. How can he help in initiating the same dialogue in Virginia where he is? And this is it, people. I think this is a bit of like self-boosting. What was different about us is that we wanted to be very relevant and very relatable to the Egyptians. We did not present ourselves as an academic project. Yeah. We're very serious. We are very top-bottom. We only talk evidence and science. Everything we produced is scientific and is evidence-based. But it has such an Egyptian light touch to it, that people can easily feel that they can easily relate to us, feel that we are a safe space, they trust us. And this means the world to me. It's just the level of trust that we got from the community is so meaningful and it's so heartwarming, but it's equally, it comes with a lot of responsibility as well.
I'm sure it does. I mean, I'm really intrigued as, I classify myself as a public archaeologist to some degree.
Yeah, you are.
But I mean, within a Western context, public history and public archaeology are things like TV series and public lectures and that type of outreach. a podcast even, but it's still very much driven as the expert talking to the general public.
Yeah,
so I'm really excited about this idea of it being far more grassroots.
Yes, it's far more grassroots, and even anything that the project produces gets released through the accounts of the artists first, and we're just secondary to whatever, to their own platforms. And they have full ownership over the copyrights. They have full ownership over how ideas are developed, and we do not control the narrative by any means. It's all up to them. We are only there to help and provide evidence, to provide archival photographs or objects, and perhaps like the scientific interpretation, or what is perceived today as the scientific interpretation of these objects. That's all what we offer. Anything else is their interpretation, their thinking is their ownership. They own it. They own this narrative too.
Excellent, excellent. I guess that segues into the question I'm going to ask next, which is more about the colonial perspective and the colonial impact. You said in the seminar you gave yesterday, and I'm aware of you having said similar in the past as well, this concept that the whole world owns Egypt. And
but not us.
And so, in terms of changing that narrative and the whole early 21st century concept of decolonizing collections, decolonizing history, Australia, of course, has a very particular perspective on this from an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspective, which is not something that I can comment upon beyond more generally. But, you know, again, even as someone who works in Mediterranean archaeology, and again, a real sign of that legacy of colonialism, I've never really thought about the missing Egyptian voice myself. So how do you go about changing mindsets as well as the evidence? Getting voices in Egypt to reflect and respond, how can the project, and then more broadly, the rest of us as allies, get the West to rethink these conversations as well?
One thing that we were very keen on in the project is making sure that whatever voices that interact with us or whatever views that are presented to us doesn't go into a void, because this is usually a problem with projects of quote-unquote public engagement, that we give a lecture or we provide a workshop or a focus group or whatever, and then nothing happened. It's just this one day off activity that people get to participate in, but then their opinions and their voices are not taken on board. Nothing happened, they are not being made useful. It's just a tick box. Yeah. We've done this. Our conscience is clear.
Yeah, we've fulfilled the grant requirements.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you so much. We've done the impact that we required. But for us, impact was not a tick box on an ethical form. That's not what we were looking for. If that's what we were after, we could have just made an exhibition in the UK. That would have been the impact that the funding body would have been extremely happy about, and that was it. But there is no core meaningful value in this. So what we've done is that all the comics that we've produced were evidence-based, based on certain objects in museum collections or based on certain archival photographs. All of these comics that were developed on a single object are currently fed back into the database of these museums. So you would find the entry of the object, but then equally with this very same entry, there will be the comic. So again, it's an added layer of meaning to the object. We don't only have the curatorial commentary, but we equally have the Egyptian response to this object, to this very same object, or to this archival photograph, as well as the other responses that came from social media. That was our way of ensuring that these voices are there to stay, that these are meaningful. And documentation is key.
Yeah.
And it is important that these voices are fed back into the collection databases because they are as important as the curatorial voice.
Yeah.
This is,
and in many ways more important.
Exactly. That's I would argue this, but I don't want to offend anyone. For me, it's far more important because it's far more meaningful. It means something on an individual, emotional, personal level that we usually tend to miss when working with things claiming being objective, being scientific, which is important, but we miss out on the real value of that these objects have on people's lives, be it in the past or today.
Yes.
So this was one of the things that we've done. We made sure that things are fed back into databases, but we equally were keen on developing, making sure that the project is part of the existing museum activity, be it in having a web page absolutely in Egyptian Arabic, which is a first in the world of museology. Usually, perception is reflecting on just the perception is just to translate into Arabic, yes. And then people don't realize that the dialect or the way we interact, this is far important. Choosing the wording, yes. And the how you interact with the community is far important. Formal classical Arabic is quite formal. At least for me, it reminds me of the news, which is usually bad news.
Yes, right.
When it comes to our part of the world, it's very academic and very formal. So we've done it in the Egyptian dialect, which means that it could be available for a variety of literacies. But equally, our comics are currently part of other initiatives within Egypt, like the Tawassul, the community school. They have our set of comics. They use it to teach Arabic.
Oh, great.
So it's good for literacy because this is a community school for underrepresented groups, those who do not have equal opportunities when it comes to formal education. So they could be at later stages of their life and still learning how to read and write. And because of how fun they are, they encourage play learning, comics.
Yeah.
So they are currently part of the curriculum to teach Arabic at the community
Fantastic.
School. And that's an important impact. Yeah. That's giving back to the community, creating something that could be useful for them to use.
But also putting those concepts and
exactly.
those conversations right in the very scaffolding foundations of education.
And some Egypt migration groups, there is a project called Egypt Migrations that is in Canada. They use some of our comics to reflect on colonial history, and they use it as part of their evidence of how systematic and historic racism against immigrant communities have been.
So you feel that a project like this has a real value, not just for Egyptians living in Egypt, but also for the dispersed
for the
community.
Diaspora. Yes, yeah. yes. But equally for, exactly, the dispersed, not only the heritage, but the dispersed Egyptian community.
Excellent, excellent. I mean, I'm also intrigued to know, as part of this sort of broader global conversation about decolonizing, have you found, in your time in Australia, but also looking at other perspectives, are there opportunities to actually pick up the way that other Indigenous groups have worked with museums or responded to museums or responded to narratives that could be brought into the project or brought into the broader conversation within Egypt?
Yes, I think Indigenous studies and the way that Australia is trying to make reparation and repatriation is very interesting and has a lot that a field like Egyptology or a field like the study of the heritage and archaeology of the Middle East can draw examples from and can learn from or perhaps unlearn from. I find it extremely interesting how there is so much Indigenous work in the New South Wales Art Gallery that was extremely interesting. It was even art made by a Lebanese Australian, and she was reflecting on the biases in the maps and how certain regions, continents, Africa or Asia, look very tiny compared to how Europe. And she weaved it into an Irani carpet, something that I would have in my home as well. And I immediately felt I belonged to this gallery. There was a sense of belonging in me that, there is someone else who understands the issues that I face. And I think it's this openness to Indigenous ideas and this openness to minorities in the art galleries that I've visited in Australia, and equally the museums. There is so much that other museums, particularly around Europe, can learn from.
We still have a long way to go, though.
Yeah, but I think you're on the right path.
Well, on that note, you've spent pretty much all day yesterday looking at the Chowchakwin Museum collection. I mean, that concept you mentioned before, but are you still mind blown by this extent of the dispersal of Egyptian antiquities? I mean, there is a certain degree of logic, albeit framed very much within a colonial perspective, but there is a logic to Egyptian material being in Rome or in Britain or in Germany, but in Sydney or Melbourne?
Yeah, well, because there is the Alamein, the Alamein War, and the Australian soldiers. This is what came to my mind. And when I've had the opportunity while here at the Hyde Park to visit the Anzac Memorial, and I saw Egypt there in the war for Alamein and the fountain of Alamein that you'd see. So there is something. There are relationships already, war relationships. But that usually in that context ended up into object export as well.
Yes, it did.
Like, so this is equally, it's equally important for the people to see, because I think here you get the full picture that I'm trying to make people realize, that usually in other museums around the world, or even here, the one in the University of Sydney, in the Chowchuck Museum, that colonialism or the colonial history of extraction is presented very much as like a peaceful history. There were just people coming in, taking objects and leaving. There were no boots on the ground. But one archival photograph I saw yesterday, a few soldiers in their full uniform and boots sitting on top of the Giza pyramids. These are the boots on the ground for you. That history was not as peaceful as people fantasize or love to think.
Yes.
And I think here you've got an opportunity to show, like, there were a lot of lives lost in the process, because I understand that in the Anzac Memorial, or in most of the memorials here, it celebrates the lives of the Australian soldiers who were lost in Al-Alamein, but there were a lot of Egyptian lives lost, and I have to say, because of the mines, there are Egyptian lives that are still lost today because of the mines that we are stuck with. We are still struggling from the legacies of colonialism of World War II. We are still, and it's not only an emotional, psychological struggle, but it's a practical struggle. We are still, we have to still face a problem that we haven't created, that is not of our making.
And it's also interesting we frame that with the concept of boots on the ground. When you look at Australian soldiers in Egypt during World War One who were training before the campaign of Gallipoli.
Exactly.
But in a sense, you've got sort of multiple. So while they weren't seeking active duty while in Egypt, although there was military campaigns later on by the Australian Light Horse against the Ottomans, but there is that really interesting perspective of they're still only there because of a decision being made in London.
Exactly. It's not their war either.
No. Yeah. And it's you know, everyone sort of being pawns in that bigger game. There is, of course, that multiple layers of colonialism within the perspective of Egypt, of Ottoman control, then European control as well.
Exactly, which is something that people tend to miss when it comes to the dispersal of Egyptian heritage. There is usually the excuse that there was a law, the Partage law, that this has been legal, but no one realizes Egypt was under double colonialism, if not triple at times. Yeah. There were the British, there was the Khedivi, who's not Egyptian himself. Yes. So Egyptians had no right to rule over their own country, over their own land. So this, by default, for me, makes these laws illegal. But it's interesting how, like, you really have to prove this to the world, because you would think this is something very simple and you don't really need to justify it, or you don't need to, because it's obvious. But it's not.
Because historical narratives only choose particular bits. So from our perspective, it's all about the heroes of Gallipoli.
Yeah, but also people don't realize that the Khedivi is not Egyptian. Many Egyptologists who study ancient, who should know better about Egypt, they don't realize that he wasn't really Egyptian. Muhammad Ali wasn't Egyptian. That since Alexander the Great, from Alexander the Great up till 1952, Egypt was ruled by foreigners. And it's interesting how many people who study or focus on the ancient, what they perceive as the ancient Egyptian past, know very little about these details. Recent, some don't even know that Egypt was colonized. They came to know this very late in their careers.
So it's about teaching all of Egyptian history, not just the ancient.
I think it's only fair if someone is interested on a certain culture. You can pick what you can pick, of course, what you specialize in. You're not expected to specialize in everything. But I think you should have a general understanding of the whole country, not just the concept. And you have to be willing to unlearn more than learn. And at times you need to realize when I should step back and let others educate me.
You're listening to Object Matters. My guest for this episode is Dr. Heba Abdul El Gawad. Heba, when you walk around a museum like the Chowchuck Wing Museum and you see Egyptian antiquities so far from their place of manufacture, so far from their home, what emotions do you feel on a personal level?
On a personal level, how honest can I be?
I encourage honesty.
Okay. Perhaps it's best I speak on the example here at Chowchuck Museum, because that was, I wouldn't call it interesting, but a bit unsettling. And if you allow me to be very honest.
Please, please.
But it wasn't the display as much as it was the cultural safety sign that I encountered at the very entrance of the galleries, which ironically made me feel extremely unsafe. It spoke on the smoking ritual that was conducted on the Egyptian human remains and on the space, which was made out of respect for the Aboriginal and communities here in Australia, who I have all the acknowledgement and all respect for. But I felt that remains that are non-Australian are becoming Australian, that you like, it's exactly how I feel in the UK, that Egypt became part of the Australia story.
Yep.
Like Egypt is part of the British story. And it made me feel extremely unsettled, extremely upset, extremely unsafe, although this was meant to induce safety in me,
yes,
that this is a safe space. No, it wasn't, because the first thing that came to mind, were any Egyptian members of the community invited to this ritual? What makes it respectful or safe to conduct a non-Egyptian ritual onto Egyptian human remains?
Yes.
And even if this is meant to purify and to bring respect, which I'm sure the ancient Egyptians would have acknowledged and would have been grateful for, but they would have equally questioned whether there were any members of those attending the ritual Egyptians.
So based on that observation and that feeling, are there any recommendations in terms of how we could work better to make that a safer space, both for the objects, but also for members of the Egyptian Australian community who come to visit the museum?
Yes, there are plenty. And on my way to campus today and yesterday in the lecture, I've met a lot of Egyptians. They are there. They are outside your doors. And it is a responsibility. It's not just a luxury, or it's not just an engagement tick box that museums have. It is at the core of your responsibility to make sure that the Egyptian voices, particularly those at your doorsteps, those who the museum can and should contribute to their lives and have an immediate responsibility to, are included, and their voices, their views, and their validity is there within the museum structure, not only in displays, but equally in the process, any decision-making process that involves the Egyptian material. They have to be included.
Much to take on board there, much to consider. My final question for you, what would you like visitors to the museum who see the displays of mummified human remains or of other cultural material from Egypt's long past on display in the Chowchak Wing Museum, be they members of the Egyptian Australian community or be they members of the broader community, what would you like them to contemplate when they're looking at those wonderful, wonderful objects?
I think put themselves on the other side, put themselves in the shoes of the ancient humans who were once the owners of these objects, who might have invested all their life savings in making a tiny, small piece of jewelry that they can take together with them to the afterlife, or that the human remain that you're encountering could easily be your family member, could be you one day.
Yeah.
How would you feel? It's just swapping positions. Be on the other side rather than be looking at the display case through the glass. Be on the other side of the display case and put yourself in there. How would you feel if someone is gazing at you at this way? Or how would you feel if something that is very precious to you has traveled all the way across continents, not only without your consent, but equally perhaps displayed in a way that doesn't conform with how you perceived and how you used this object? It's turning into an artifact,
yeah,
rather than part of your living history,
yeah,
lived experience.
That's an observation applicable not just to Egypt, but
to anywhere
all of
around
the
world. Yes,
yeah,
to anywhere around the world.
Thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure being here and talking to you particularly.
Thank you. Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chowchak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney pays our respects to the traditional owners of the lands on which we work.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.